Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we're now in our fall pledge drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online to kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Once again, thanks for supporting KBOO. A couple weeks ago, I went out to Chinook Point on the Washington side of the Columbia River near its mouth to talk with Sam Robinson, a longtime Lower Chinook Tribal Council member, about the history of his people and the land they know better than any of us whose ancestors are from elsewhere. Today on Locus Focus, we listen to that conversation.
Ho, 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 hey. Ho, ho.
Sam, welcome to Locus Focus.
Shalom. Nakanim Sam Robinson. My father was Scott Robinson. His mother was Dora Clark. Dora Clark's mother was Annie Hawks. And Annie Hawks' father was John Hawks. And John Hawks was enrolled over at Showwater Bay. And John Hawks was married to Nellie Cecina, a Chehalis woman. And John's mother was Catherine George, Chai East, or Catherine George. She was a Willapaw woman. And she was married to Thomas Huxwelt, a Lower Chinook man, and Thomas Huxwelt was a signer of the 1851 Anson Dart Treaty at Tansy Point, and that's why I'm able to be here with you today.
So where are we exactly?
We're Chinook Point, you know. Chinook Point is a very inspirational people for area for Chinook. You know, we have our first salmon ceremony here where we catch that salmon and all in how we, the taboos and how we kill it and who eats it and prepare it. But the end result is after everything's been eaten, that we take those bones and we return them back out to the river so that they can go out into the ocean and tell all the other fish that the Chinook has treated him with respect and that it's okay to come up the river. Chinook realizes that other tribes do their first salmon ceremony, so we'll usually let some of the fish go up river, you know, so that first so that they can get their ceremonies out of the way, and then we'll have ours, you know, later on. So we want to make sure we honor those people in Warm Springs and Grand Ronde, where all those other Chinook people are.
Let's talk about this whole location. I mean, describe this little cove we're at, and then let's sort of circle wider until we get maybe all the way to Saddle Mountain.
Oh, sloosh. So we're down here at Chinook Point. There's a cove, you know, and the cove's very interesting. I imagine you can set about 30, maybe 40 canoes in here. And back in the day when trading first started and the tall ships were coming in to do trading, a lot of Chinook people would wait in this little cove because the rocks that let you out the outlet are so tight that you can get one canoe out at a time and you can't really see it from out there on the river. And so they would sit here and watch, and when they saw a tall ship, they would take off. And I've had the luxury of sitting in here in a canoe and looking out and seeing the Lady Washington, a replica of that first ship that came up the river, Captain Gray's ship, and shoot out of the cove, you know, to go do a trade with them. And I always want to you know, respect my ancestors and honor them by trading in the Chinook way. You know, they say that Chinook were traditional, really shrewd traders. They said they will offer you one, and Chinook would say, we want three. And that's the way I live today.
I want to describe physically what this looks like, and also, where are we exactly in relationship to the Columbia River, the Pacific Ocean, Washington, Oregon, and Chinookan lands?
Yeah, we're kind of like in the middle of the lower Chinook land, you know, because we're on the Washington side. We're a little bit east of Ilwaco, Baker Bay, so, you know, Chinook people are living over there. We're downriver for several villages, Chinook villages, like in Pillar Rock, Dahlia. You know, our five tribes in our nation are the Clatsop, the Kathlamet, the Willapa, Wakayakum, and Lower Chinook. So we're not only a Washington tribe, but we're an Oregon tribe as well. And so, anyway, we go up to about to Oak Point up by Longview. And then both sides of the river all the way down into Tillamook and then up into the Willapa Bay. So this place is very special. You know, this is a place where Chief Comley's mother, who was really a high status woman, lived. And then later on, when the Bostons came in, that was, you know, the Europeans, when the Bostons came in to the river, that's our Chinook word for Europeans, she didn't want to deal with them. So she lifted up her son, raised him up in status, and sent him off to do all the work. And Comley became a real prominent a figure in early trade with the Astors and Hudson Bay and everyone else. He controlled the fur trade up and down this river. He told the people up in the middle river not to deal with the Bostons, they would kill him. He told the Bostons not to deal with those upper river people, they would kill him. So he controlled all the trade up and down this river. You know, became a high status man. In the Chinook ways, you know, when you marry a woman, you marry her resources. Or if you send your daughter off to marry somebody else, you know, you get that connection with the resources. So when the Bostons came in, you know, Comley, he was pretty bright, and he knew that he needed to marry his daughters off to some of the Hudson Bay people or some of the Astors. So they became pretty prominent in the area as well. He was pretty smart. They said when he walked the earth that they would lay furs in front of his feet so his feet wouldn't have to touch the ground.
Well, going back in time and a little bit to the east, I wanted to talk about Saddle Mountain, which is a place that I'm pretty familiar with, but I learned a special thing when I was watching this webinar that you did back in the spring. So what is Saddle Mountain? What is its significance to the Chinook?
Saddle Mountain is where all the Chinook people came from, you know, and, you know, it's taboo to tell stories out of season, so maybe I'll give you a little condensed story of it, you know, and it's not like something huge is going to happen to you, but, you know, if you do things out of season, you know, you might get stung by a bee or bit by a snake or something, but those are taboos that Chinook people lived by. But with the Saddle Mountain, you know, I mean, Old Man Southwind was coming up the coast, and when he got up here, he was hungry, and he met this giantess, ogre, you know, he said, you got any food for me? I'm hungry. And she says, nope, but I can give you a net, and you can catch some fish. You know, so he cast that net out and he caught a baby whale. And she gave him a knife so he could cut the whale. And she told him, you got to cut it up the back. That's the way you need to do it, cut it up the back. Well, he ignored her and he cut it across ways, you know. And when he did that, just a big noise and happened, and out popped Thunderbird out of this whale. And Thunderbird flew to the top of Saddle Mountain and made a big nest. Thunderbird took off for a little bit and was going to come back to its eggs. Well, the ogress, the giant, she went up there and she started looking at these eggs. She wanted to eat them, and she said they were bad. She started throwing them down the hill, and as she threw them down the hill, Chinook people popped out of these eggs. So that's where we came from. And then later on, of course, you know, when the Thunderbird came back, he was mad. Old Man Southwind was definitely mad about it, and the giantess was nowhere to be found. So now, you know, in that springtime, when you hear that wind coming up the south and you hear that thunder, that's Thunderbird and Southwind coming back looking for the giantess today.
For listeners who don't know, Thunderbird refers to an actual very important bird that did live historically all along the Columbia River. So let's talk a little bit about that bird.
There was quite a few condors in the area at one time, you know, and they're big birds, you know. I'm sure that was part of the referral, and then there were some spiritual birds that were much, much bigger, you know. I'm sure, way back in the day, you know. So.
What do you mean by spiritual birds?
Well, I mean animals, you know. I mean, you know, we strongly believe that before Chinook were here, the animals thought they were humans. And they were setting down all the rules that the Chinook people were going to live by, you know, with how you dealt with birth or how you dealt with marriage or death. And, you know, salmon and bear and eagle and all those animals got together and they were just laying down the rules, you know. And someone asked one day, what did it mean to be Chinook back in the day? And it was all these taboos. Because people would say, well, what kind of ritual religion you had? He said, everything you did from the time you got up was a religion. It's how you did everything, you know. I mean, you're like walking down a path and you see a frog in the middle of the path, you always go to the right. Or if a woman's pregnant, she never wears any beads because she doesn't want to confuse that child in her womb that say it's okay to wrap something around its neck, you know. So there are all kinds of taboos that Chinook people would live by. And we can't live by them all today in the modern world, but, you know, when we have our ceremonies, we try to hit them the best, and we'll ask the ancestors' forgiveness just because we know we're not living that way, you know. So, and I think they're happy. I've seen strong evidence, you know, that the ancestors are happy. I mean, even nearby here, I've seen some really, really amazing things happen.
Well, as far as Saddle Mountain goes, we were hopefully going to be here on a clear day, which we're not. But you can see Saddle Mountain from Chinook Point. Is that correct?
Everywhere.
So let's describe the role that Saddle Mountain plays in this region and for your people.
Well, we're just happy that, you know, all the way from Dahlia, you know, you can be all the way over by Long Beach. You can be up in the hills behind us. You can be down by Cannon Beach, Seaside. You can be almost anywhere in this lower Chinook territory and see Saddle Mountain. So it kind of gives you an anchor. It kind of grabs you, you know, yeah, you're in Chinook country. You're in Chinook country today. And the other thing about this place we're at here, Chinook Point, is that we have a lot of ancestors in these hills. And there was a village just upriver, a quarter mile, there was a village there. It was like Chinook's Fort Vancouver. I mean, it was a trading hub for Chinook people. And we would live there probably about 8 months out of the year and then go winter in Nacelle. Lewis and Clark, when they came down, they were only there for 3 days, you know. And they made some serious mistakes when they were there. You know, I mean, the Chinook people were friendly and everything was good, but they didn't communicate well with those Chinook people there. You know, when Lewis and Clark came down, originally they were supposed to cut a ship, and that ship was going to take them back. So they were talking to the Chinook people. They were trying to determine whether they were going to go back up to Washougal because they knew that there was a lot of deer and stuff in that area and winter there. Some Clatsop Chinook said, hey, over here at Chinook Prairie, there's a lot of elk. You know, and so they had to make their decision. Well, they didn't tell the Chinook people where they were going. So about 3 days later, a ship came in, and they were asking the Chinook people, did you see these guys? Yeah, we did. We saw them. Where'd they go? They went upriver. Oh, okay. And then the ship took off. They were only like 6 miles away. But had they told the Chinook, oh, we're going upriver because we can't cross the river, it's too wide here, we would have said they were over there and they would have got their ride back, but they didn't do that. So poor communication.
What happened to them?
What happened to them? Well, they ended up having to go back overland. So, yeah, and that wasn't a pretty sight either. And they even stole the canoe. They stole one of our canoes on the south shore there. So late 200 years later, fast forward, you know, during the Lewis and Clark commemoration, you know, it was kind of a tough choice on whether we were going to participate or not. You know, we knew the Lakota were protesting on the other end, and we didn't know what they really brought Chinook, you know, into our territory other than another path into our territory. But my cousin, my late cousin Ray, and I, he was chairman, I was vice chairman, decided that we needed to tell our story across the United States, and this was a good venue to do it. So anyway, we partook in the Lewis and Clark deal, so we were able to speak about them. And Ray was eventually asked to be on the board of American Rivers, you know, which is pretty prominent status there, you know. I accused him of being a multimillionaire, because most of those guys are. But he's not. But anyway, so when he got on the board, this gentleman, Rick Holt, and his wife, Lotsi, was a fifth generation descendant of William Clark. So Ray would always be ribbing her about that stolen canoe, you know. And one year, Ray was supposed to go back and help bless a river in the St. Louis area that was cleansed. And he couldn't make it because he was having some heart surgery. And he sent a prayer. And they read his prayer, And a gentleman from the Osage tribe stood up, the local tribe, and he knew nothing about Lhotse, he knew nothing about Ray or the Stolen, nothing, you know. But what he did say in his words was that the Osage strongly believed that a seventh generation descendant of William Clark was going to correct the injustices, one of the injustices that happened along the trail. So that evening, Lhotse started thinking of her two grandsons. And she called up Ray that evening and said, "Ray, the Clark family wants to replace that canoe. We want to know how big and what kind." So it took a while to determine between cultural committee and, you know, we knew we couldn't get a big enough log to do a big canoe, and we wanted a big canoe, you know, so we went with another style. So we knew what kind. And then they said, "Well, how big?" We said, "Well, that's easy. Three's lucky in Chinook, so it's got to be 3 feet longer than Skunkia, Grand Ronde's canoe." So we end up with a 36-foot canoe, 6 feet wide, holds 12 polars, 4 extra passengers, and we have taken that out in the ocean, out of the Willapaw Bay, and paddled all the way up to Nia Bay, 3 days, and then around the corner into Seattle, up into Canada. So it's a big canoe, not as big as those 50-foot freighters that our ancestors had, but it's a big canoe, and we feel good about it. And unfortunately, this week we should be on canoe journey going up into Canada, and yeah, it was canceled this year, so we're all feeling like there's a void in us not being out on the water today.
You're listening to Locust Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today, we're talking with Chinook Tribal Council member Sam Robinson.
You're wearing a t-shirt that says "Paddle to Swinomish." Let's talk a bit about what the canoe journey is and how that's a reflection of the importance that canoes play in all the tribal people that live in the Northwest.
Canoe journey started out with 5 canoes that came out of Quinault. Emmett Oliver, he's a Chinook man, and he was instrumental in getting it going. And what had happened was they had a feeling that there was people that they had a lot of drug out problems and, you know, other problems that were going on, and they hadn't connected with their ancestors in a long time. So they decided they were going to, during the Centennial Accord, they were going to go ahead and paddle to Seattle with 5 canoes. So they made it around the Horn and they paddled in. And from that point on, it just kept growing, you know, and more canoes, you know, coming out there. And really for tribes, it's a gift, because all of a sudden now you got more people interested in making regalia, the cedar hats and pulling the bark and learning how to pull bark. I mean, you just don't go and rip some bark off a tree. You find a tree that's perfect for pulling bark. Usually a tree you can hug is the best for the thickness of the bark, and then you have a relationship with that tree and talk to that tree, and then you go and you cut a piece about maybe 8 inches wide and you just pull it as far as you can, and when you're done you make sure you leave it with a song and some tobacco, a gift, you know. So, you know, there's certain ways to do it. And I've been out in the forest and I've seen trees that are big and round, and you can see where scar has sealed up from where our ancestors maybe 300-400 years ago had pulled a piece of bark off that tree.
Why is it so important to reintroduce the next generations of Indigenous people to the canoe?
I think it's hugely strong in the mental health and teaching our youth respect. You know, respect for elders, respect for the ancestors, respect for the canoe. We're out there, you know, 8, 10, 12 days in a row. We're probably in the canoe anywhere between 8 and 14 hours a day. 14 hours means you're probably going to be bucking a tide sooner or later, so you're a little bit late. And you're going from village to village. You know, you'll leave your village and you pull into another area. You tell them you're tired, you're hungry, and, you know, and they'll say, "Come ashore." They'll say, "We got some snacks for you." And I remember one day we pulled up in Port Gamble, and I'm looking for a pop-up tent or something, you know, where we can get the snacks. And I saw people standing by the beach, and when I walked over there, it was about 8 feet wide and 20 feet long. It was just a bed of coals and nothing but oysters and clams down there for you to pick up out of the beach and eat. That was our snack. And then later on, you know, we get showers, and then we'll get a dinner meal. And then after that, you show your gratitude. You know, you take the floor and you sing, you dance, maybe do a little bit of gifting to some veterans, elders, youth. And then the next morning, depending on the tides, it could be 4 o'clock in the morning, you get up and get back out on the water and take those people with you and go to the next village and keep doing that. And you got people coming from inland Canada. It takes about 30 days to come down to the Seattle area. You got people coming from the coast, you know, both sides of BC. You got people coming down the Columbia River, all over the place, and we're all merging one area. And in today's world, you're going to see 115 canoes arriving from all different nations. And that singing and dancing on that final area goes for about 5 or 6 days. And great seafood all the way, all the way.
Well, we left off your story with Lewis and Clark, which is a little over 200 years. So I want to jump forward about another 60 years. You talked about the Bluecoats. What happened between the time that Lewis and Clark came here and discovered you to the point where you started meeting real armed resistance from the federal government of the United States?
Well, first thing I want to clarify, when I'm out speaking about Lewis and Clark, I usually refer to them as Clueless and Lark, because they're coming the wrong direction. All the other Bostons for 3 decades were coming up the river, and all of a sudden these guys are coming down the river. Granted, they were a little lost, you know, you got over that dismal niche over there and they're hunkered down for 3 days and starving and they couldn't get up the hill or whatever it was. And it was one of our chiefs, that came across the river standing up in the canoe as he's approaching them and offering them fish. They didn't want our fish, but they wanted our dogs, so that became a joke, you know, for us, you know, during the whole Lewis and Clark thing. My feeling was, is the reason is these people ate a lot of protein. When they got up into the Celilo area where they were, you know, you could take a, you know, 25-pound fish and pack it down into about a quart jar of protein, they probably ate a lot of that. And then they probably ate way too much of that, and then they drank a bunch of ale and they got sick. Because they said they got sick off the fish. And then when they look down the river and they see those hook-nosed tulies, they swore off salmon at that time. So that's why they wanted our dogs. So it became a big joke. But 200 years later, we were having fundraisers and we'd always have Lewis and Clark dogs that we were selling hot dogs. You know.
What triggered your clashes with the federal troops?
Fort Columbia here, you know, was clearly established during the Civil War. And the Bluecoats were up and down the Long Beach Peninsula. I think they were here to really protect people from us, but I've heard many stories where, you know, they weren't the best hunters in the world, so they'd actually give their rifles to the Chinook people so the Chinook people can go out and provide food for them. So I don't think they were too fearful that we were gonna hurt them. We signed a treaty, you know, over Tansy Point across the way over on the Oregon side by Warrenton. The significance of Tansy Point is that everybody that was Chinook had to be there for that. So everybody, every single person that we all descend from today was at Tansy Point. And so we signed that treaty. The treaty was gonna, you know, when Anson-Dark came down, you know, I think originally he wanted to move us out of our territory, but he realized that there was a good relationship going on down here. So he wasn't gonna move us out of our territory. He was gonna move us into South Willapa Bay down by Nacelle River. And we were good with that because we didn't want to leave the bones of our ancestors. So we signed the treaty in good faith, you know. It became a hard winter for us because, you know, knowing that the federal government said they were going to give us a lot of supplies and stuff, our hunters and so forth decided they didn't have to hunt so hard or gather so much. Stuff never came and we almost starved because we didn't have so much food. But those treaties went back to the Senate and the Senate didn't ratify them. There was a couple reasons, you know, we felt that they didn't do it. But I think one of the main reasons was is that they said we were so infected with malaria and measles that we'd be gone, not to worry about Chinook.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about why you were so infected with malaria and measles, as well as a few other illnesses.
Oh, well, you know, Chinook people, even 400 years before European contact, the Spanish came through, and our first episode of plague would be smallpox. So, and then later on, when the Bostons or the Europeans came up the river, they always stop off in the today Hawaiian Islands and come over, and that's where they, you know, they brought malaria. There was the fever as well, and measles. And so on this Columbia River, we lost 95% of our population. And it was happening fast. You know, I mean, these villages were just closing down left and right. It was terrible. We felt pretty honored to be here today for what our ancestors have gone through. And that's a lot why we do what we do today, is for those ancestors. We know that life was hell for them for a long time. But anyway, so we signed that treaty. It wasn't ratified. Later on, they found out that we hadn't perished 4 years later. So they invited us to the Chehalis River Treaty up at Anacortes there. And they invited us and the Chehalis and the Cowlitz to this treaty. And Governor Stevens came in. And it was 3 days of treaty.
By the way, when was this?
1855. Yeah, 1851 was the first treaty. And I'd go back a little bit. As my third great grandfather, Thomas Huxwell, his signature's on that treaty. So I'm pretty proud of that. So in 1855, anyway, they invited us up there to another treaty. Governor Stevens came in, and one good story I like, a short story, is that he walked in the room, and, you know, of course he thinks he's all that, you know, governor of the territory, and there's a gentleman sitting on the floor that wouldn't get up and shake his hand. And he was getting a little irate about that. And the gentleman said to him, he said, "You went to school for several years to become a governor of the territory. I was born a chief."
None of these tribes were ever recognized federally?
We had our federal status end of the Clinton administration. Kevin Gover was the head of the BIA, Assistant Secretary of Interior, and he saw that how Chinook was being treated, and he just felt that that wasn't right, that the history was there, everything was proven, and he signed our recognition. The Cowlitz got their recognition signed maybe about 3 months earlier. Well, what happened with us is it was so late in the term that when it got into Bush administration, Gail Norton overturned it 18 months later. And the ironic thing was is that I'm a firm believer that the presidents don't know everything, you know, that's going on in their watch. Because what had happened was is for the Lewis and Clark kickoff, they made sure they invited all the tribal leaders that were along the, from the tribes that were along the Lewis and Clark Trail, federally recognized tribal leaders. So Gary Johnson and his wife were there because we were federally recognized. And so I think it was either Thursday or Friday, they were walking out through DC, and it was towards the end of the day, and they get a call from some low management person or something, and they told us that they turned us down, that they pulled our recognition. So pretty tough, you know. One day, you know, you're being honored by the president, and the next day it's being yarded out from underneath you. It took us a long time just to try to figure out where we're going next, you know.
The Cowlitz were terminated, weren't they, at some point?
I don't know that they were in the Termination Act. I think they just didn't have a treaty. So what had happened is probably in the early 60s, they wanted to clean up the list of tribes. Now, in order to get rid of a tribe, it takes an act of Congress. So they gave this gal this responsibility to clean up the list, and she was trying to figure out how to do it, even though it wasn't her job to do it, you know? And so the only thing she could come up with is that these tribes are landless tribes because their treaties were never ratified, so therefore they're gone. Stroke of a pen took out over 100 tribes, and Chinook was one of them, and Cowlitz, you know.
How about Chehalis?
Chehalis, you know, they did sign a treaty. They have a reservation. But there's a lot of tribes in the state of Washington that weren't tribes. If you go back 30 years ago, that weren't federally recognized tribe. We keep saying, hey, you know, Chinook just hasn't been taken care of. You know, we're not saying we're not recognized, because all these tribes and people recognize us. We're just saying we need to correct our federal status.
Why is it so important to have federal recognition at this point?
It gives you a place at the table, you know. I mean, you know, when it comes to taking care of Mother Earth, I always tell people, I said, if you want to get things done, you need to have a federally recognized tribe in your backyard, because the tribes know how to get things done, you know, and they know how to do it right. You know, our ancestors were taking care of these lands for thousands of years, you know, and tens of thousands of years, and things were good for a long time, you know. And then, you know, later on, you know, European influence came in, and it started messing things up, you know, overfishing, and, you know, in the Columbia River, you know, the Chinese are in here putting in fish wheels, and on and on and on, you know. And so a lot of things were going on, you know, in our territory, because we weren't in charge anymore. We just didn't have the numbers. You know, it used to be back in the day that you wouldn't come down on this Columbia River if you weren't Chinook. And the way you'd be able to identify us is that our ancestors would have flattened heads, because they would flatten their heads at birth. So if you're a round head, you could be subject to be killed or become a slave. I know tribal leaders from other tribes that were off the river would actually flatten their daughters' heads at birth so they could marry them into what was going on this Columbia River.
You're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today, we're talking with Chinook Tribal Council member Sam Robinson.
Are you still trying to get recognition?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we need to correct our status. We have a lot of needs, because recognition brings a lot of things. We may not have a reservation, but we have the problems that they have on reservations. You know, we have people that have alcohol problems and drug problems and mental problems, and we want to be able to help them. And right now we're looking for ways to do it without recognition. We're trying to maybe establish a mental health clinic in Pacific County, not only to take care of Chinook people, but take care of our neighbors. I think there's a strong need for it. But recognition also brings, you know, health care for our people. It brings education for our people. And plus, you got to be able to take care of this. And if we're not recognized, other people will encroach.
Well, you mentioned that your people, and I think it's probably true of most Indigenous people, know how to take care of the land. I think that's true all around the world. And I'm thinking about some critical struggles that are going on in the Northwest, whether it's fighting in the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal in Coos Bay and the Pacific Gas Connector Pipeline, which is a fight that's being led by the Klamath, the Yurok, the Hoopa, now the Coos, the Isala. And then also up in Tacoma, where they're fighting the LNG facility there, it's a fight that's being led by the Puyallup. What role do you see your tribe in leading and in ensuring that these struggles that are also involving non-Indigenous communities are rooted in this place and rooted in an understanding of what this place is about?
One of the things that we really want to focus on early on, of course, and we're trying to work on that today, is just, reestablishing a healthy ecosystem. And whatever that takes, you know, it might be from breaching dikes to opening up areas to so on, but everything that comes in this river, everything affects Chinook's territory. And we're trying to let those people upriver know that too, that everything they do up there clearly affects us down here. We need to have a bigger voice at the table. And you know, like I said, you can have a place at the table, but you don't get as much clout as those federally recognized tribes. So I think to get a louder voice, we really need to have our status corrected.
Well, I'm thinking actually another great case is the Yakima, who are leading the fight to clean up Hanford.
Yeah.
Do you get inspiration from seeing what the Yakima have been doing?
We get inspiration from a lot of tribes, yeah. You know, I mean, we see, they're taking care of what they're doing. You know, we look at Grand Ronde and look at what they're doing, and we actually were very good friends with Grand Ronde, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel when it comes to doing certain things. We can just follow their lead, and they're more than willing to help us out. Yeah, we're pretty proud of those people. Stand the ground, you know. This is Chinook country. We need to be able to protect it, and we can't do that today. You know, it wasn't until we bought Tansy Point. For years, we kept telling people we're a Washington and Oregon tribe. No, you're a Washington tribe. Your office is up in Bay Center, Washington. You're a Washington tribe, Washington tribe, Washington tribe. Even though two of our tribes were named in that Termination Act in 1954, clearly Oregon tribes, you know, in our nation. And but when we purchased Tansy Point, all of a sudden it was like, wow, they're an Oregon tribe. We need to talk to them. You know, so it's like, whoa, we've been telling you that all along. This river was not a divider. This river was just a road that ran between our communities.
I'm wondering what your relationship is with the upriver Chinook, because actually in my own experience of learning about the Indigenous people on the Columbia River, I knew about the Chinook villages in Portland, for one thing, and then all the way up the river, probably up to Yakima land. Do you feel like you're not the same tribe exactly,
no.
Right? But what is the relationship?
We got a lot of cousins up there, though, you think about it, you know. I mean, I think, Lillian Pitt and a few of those artists up in that area, they respect Chinook, and we respect them, and we have good relationships, and people up in Salilo Village and so on, and Grand Ronde, you know, three Chinook tribes down in Grand Ronde. We share a lot with them back and forth, and when it comes to culture, and, you know, in fact, Tony Johnson, our chairman today, he worked for Grand Ronde. He was instrumental in getting their language going down there and the immersion program, you know, in Grand Ronde. They're able to take all these little kids in elementary school, and they put them in these immersion programs, and they can only speak Wawa up until noon, and then they can speak Boston afterwards. And they'll bust each other's chops, you know. Oh, Billy Yakanim Wawa, or Boston, Billy Yakanim, he's speaking, you know, Boston, you know. So yeah. The ironic thing was back in the day, the elders were speaking their dialects. Some of our ancestors spoke five different languages, you know, and they were speaking Chinook, you know, and back in the day when they didn't want the kids to know. And then all of a sudden the kids have this little code thing going on. So now all of a sudden the elders, their parents are starting to learn it, you know. And so it just kind of comes back around.
Let's talk about the elders. I mean, you mentioned in this webinar that I watched that the elders, you call them the library.
Yeah, they're a huge resource of libraries for us, you know. And this whole COVID thing, they're just like, it's hard for them to understand why we can't get together. You know, I mean, they would just love to. They're missing it. You know, I see them on Zoom, and it's like, oh, yeah, I miss you guys. I wish we could get together, you know. And because they're used to those functions, those tribal functions, a certain amount of respect that you treat your elders with. You know, we teach our young from early on. My granddaughter Destiny, you know, she's 15 now, but you know, she's Chinook to the core. Chupi, Grandpa Chupi's been dragging her around ever since she was born, you know, and she's singing and dancing with me all along. So she's a generation that has always known plank houses, has always known canoes, always known songs and language. It's like something I didn't have when I was growing up. So, you know, our youth is very important, but they know how to respect the elder. I mean, she was probably 2 or 3 years old when she started bringing plates of food to elders that didn't need to get up. You need to bring them, you need to take care of them. So it's important to get that into the people to know how valuable these elders are and talk to the elders.
So what is happening to the elders now with COVID? And in the fact that, like a lot of us, they're certainly part of the more endangered generation. But I'm wondering how they're dealing with it, how they are getting support, and how they're still being appreciated.
I think most of them are hunkered down, and they have family that are taking care of them, you know, making sure that they don't get too out of line. And But I know that they miss hanging around with the youth and educating the youth and passing along that knowledge, or just to have those relationships. Destiny, my granddaughter, I mean, since she was little, she was told by elders that, you know, she's a future tribal leader. So now that she's 15, she's thinking tribal council. I said, well, you got 3 more years, so keep your ears open.
I'm remembering I was taken to a first salmon feast a couple times with Lillian Pitt. Uh-huh. And I guess the first time we went, she wasn't 60 yet. And then there's another time she went, actually I wasn't with her, but she told me that they made her sit up with the elders, and she's going, what's going on? And she realized that she was an elder. And having obviously a certain amount of Americanization, the way she grew up, she had these mixed feelings about it. But then she finally embraced the mantle. So I'm kind of curious about, is there some of that, as you say, Boston take on being old, being disrespected, or do you feel like elders in the Chinook world really do understand that they have a very special role?
I think they strongly understand. Me, I have it personally. I just have the conflict of, like, do I really have enough knowledge to be an elder? Because I don't think of an elder as being old. I'm thinking of somebody that's knowledgeable, you know. So I think people say I do, but, you know, I think, you know, I'm still learning, you know. Elder in training, you know, I'm 63 now, you know, but I don't consider myself an elder, you know, but other people's may. It's important, you know, because as those elders pass, stories get lost, and everything's verbal, you know. We're not, you know, back in the day, you weren't writing it down, you know. Your stories passed along. Today, we're at a point that we need to do that.
I wanted to talk more about the pandemic. Do you feel like the experience that Chinook and most tribes in the United States experience, being almost exterminated by disease over a period of 400 years, do you feel like that gives you any kind of insights or particular wisdom about now what all the Boston folks are going through, and not only that, but people all around the world are going through with COVID?
Well, I think we fully understand that we need to take it serious, and that we don't have the meetings, we don't get out in the canoes. We try to educate our elders. You know, we worry because obviously we don't have health care, you know, for our elders. You know, some of them have it in their Boston worlds, but not all of them do, you know. And we wish we could provide that for our people. Wish we had some clinics, you know, and take care of our people in a good way. And not only take good care of them in a good way, but have the providers that are taking care of them understand that the little things that have to happen for Native people, not just, you know. But, you know, the other thing that we're doing, we started doing before COVID, was really getting our natural resources together with our people and start going out gathering medicines and roots and foods and preparation of foods and putting stuff away. So we're trying to do that on Zoom now, but, you know, it's not the same. You could probably survive off what you see here, like our ancestors did. You know, we could go out there and catch fish, except we have no fishing rights. We hope we know. And we hope that, the Bostons kind of respect that we know and stay away.
It's funny to me because that's where I'm from originally. Oh. But I appreciate why you call them the Bostons. Yeah. We're standing right now in this cove, which is at Chinook Point. Who owns this land and why don't you own it?
Well, this is state land. And, well, I'll tell you what, they didn't buy it because they didn't ratify those treaties. So none of our land was bought. So what had happened was, you know, we went to the one treaty, they didn't ratify it. We went to the other treaty, which is supposed to buy your land. World doctrine says only two ways to take land. One is to purchase it, and the other is to go to war and take it. So we went to the first treaty, signed it in good faith, went back to the Senate. They didn't ratify it. They said, don't worry about Chinook. They're so infected with malaria, they'd be gone. 4 years later, they realized we hadn't perished. They invited us to the Chehalis River Treaty with the Kalits and Chehalis, wanting to either move us onto the Quinault Reservation with our enemies of thousands of years, because they like putting warring tribes on the same reservation, or to move us up into Yakima, totally off the river. And we told them, no, we're not gonna sign your treaty. You need to honor the treaty that we did sign, which would have gave us the South Willapa down on the Nacelle River as our, so we wouldn't have to leave the bones of our ancestors. So Governor Stevens, he tried all kinds of tricks. You know, he was gonna fill his hat with gold and give it to us if we signed the treaty, and we said no. He said that, see those ships out there, we're gonna put all the Chinook people in, we're gonna take them out and set them on fire. And we said no. And so he walked out on us. So we ended up with no treaty, no signed treaty. And then it wasn't about maybe 10, 15 years later, the federal government, just Secretary of Interior said, oh, sorry, no more treaties, we're just gonna take the land. So our land was never purchased from us. You know, it was taken unjustly. And we'll still battle that even without federal recognition, because there was no such thing as federal recognition back in the day. You know, we are the same people that signed those treaties. And you recognized us, believe me. Our timeline goes a long ways, and there's a lot of court cases that we've been in, fishing right court cases. We had people fishing until about 1968 on the Indian Blue Card as Chinook people. We had fishing rights before they yanked them out from underneath us.
Have you made any alliances with people who are working on forest issues, or actually trying to stop this group Timber Unity, which is having a growing voice in rural communities in Oregon?
We're just now getting our foot in the door in Oregon, you know, because of the purchase of Tansy Point last year. I'm sure you'll see more and more of a presence. But like I said, our resources are small. Everybody has a day job, you know. Even me, I've been on council for 20 years. It's an unpaid position, you know. So you have to go out and you have to go work and then come back and do all the Chinook work, you know. And we have a lot on our plate, you know. One of the things that's a huge issue for Chinook, we don't have the rights to protect the bones of our ancestors, because we're not fairly recognized. So often we have to work with a neighboring tribe if there's a discovery or something around here. You know, somebody's logging and they're going through a gravesite. So that's a huge issue. So we got a lot of big issues, but you know, we understand that Mother Earth needs to be protected, and we're hoping through education of our youth. We do have some scholarship money, and we're starting to, you know, getting our kids educated, and we can put them out there in those environmental fields. And you know, we have some working with the foresters, you know, to make sure that we have a healthy forest, and that because the forest is important in the health of the earth. And, you know, if you drive around Pacific County, these are all plantations. As a kid, you know, I've grown up in this area, so I've seen forests planted, cut, planted, you know, and it's you know, it's sustainable and important, very important. But it's all important how you do it, too. So you got to protect those streams, you know, you got to protect the, you know, the ecosystems of everything. You got to protect, make sure wildlife has habitat when you do it. You just can't go in there and wipe out a whole bunch of wood. You know, you just got to do it right, you know, do it respectful. I think that's one of the avenues we're going to be taking it, you know. And then the mud flats in the Willapa Bay, you know, when we did sign the treaty, they said that even though they didn't ratify that treaty, they didn't put the mud flats in there. They said that would be determined at a later date. They hadn't done that yet. So, you know, and the mudflats are very important to the Willapa Bay. You know, I mean, you go into the Willapa Bay, and when the low tide comes out, 80% of the bay is only under 3 foot of water. So it's like all this mud and all these oysters out there and clams and all that good food out there, you know. And there's issues, you know, and you got to figure out how to deal with these ghost shrimp and how to deal with different things, you know, spraying chemicals, you know, and the acidity of the waters, you know, affecting the shellfish. There's just so many different things that, you know, we need to be at the table. You know, I know when the oyster growers saw that we were getting recognition signed at the time, you know, they knew it was, the writing was on the wall, we're going to be recognized just before 2001, and they set aside some of their prime oyster beds for Chinook because they wanted us down in there with them, because they knew what we would bring to that bay, the health of that bay.
One last thing I've learned, actually, just a little over a year ago, about the seventh generation prophecy. Mm-hmm. And then I started understanding what it was about.
Yeah.
Can we talk a bit about that and how you see it being played out right now? Is it true that we are now in the seventh generation?
Well, you know, anything we do, we're thinking, thinking of those people down the road. And I'm just proud enough to say that my granddaughter is a seventh generation descendant of, you know, both Thomas Huxfeld and Catherine George. Thomas Huxfeld, who signed that Anzindar Treaty, and Catherine George was a high status woman down in there. And she, believe me, they're looking down on her and they're thinking, she's good. She's good because she totally knows who her ancestors are, and she's proud of those Chinook ancestors. And so I think it's very important, you know, to understand, you know, that we just want to make sure that good carries on for generation and generation and generation.
You're listening to Locus Focus. You're on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today, we're talking with Chinook Tribal Council member Sam Robinson.
Well, I've heard a couple of different interpretations. The first person who talked to me about it, who was actually Taylor Tupper with the Klamath Tribes, And she said the seventh generation is the generation that's going to turn things around and get in harmony with the planet. Mm. And it was not just the indigenous, it was all the young people from everywhere.
Yeah.
But I've also heard people, about 6 months later, I was at a climate rally in Tacoma, and a couple of the Puyallup people were talking about how it's either we fix it now or it's all over. So I just wonder what your take is on that.
So that's true too. You know, you got to take care of it. I mean, if it goes south on you, and it becomes a harder way to take care of it. You know, I mean, when it's sick, you got to keep it healthy. You know, otherwise, yeah, it could be gone. But my feeling is that we're doing things for the future. You know, we want to make sure it keeps going. Of course, we want Chinook to be around forever. And try to get some of those old ways back. You know, I talk to people, I'm on the board for the Friends of the Ridgefield Wildlife Refuge, and you know, it used to be an oak savanna down there, but now you got Doug fir trees, those invasive species, you know, and all these other things going on. And I said, it's a lot better when it burn. You gotta burn, you know, that's the way it has to happen. Well, out at Staggerwall Refuge out in there, they had a fire, some kids were playing with fireworks, and it burnt a lot of acres. And I said, wait until next spring. Next spring, it was just so beautiful out there. And they said, wow, you're right. So now they're doing a little bit of burning now and then on the refuge. You know, I said, you got to do it, you know. I said, when those settlers came into that Willamette Valley and they saw this pristine park out here, they're like, this is a nice place. You know, they didn't think about how it got there. They just thought it was there because it was there. No, it's because those tribes were burning all that underbrush, creating a healthy forest, getting rid of all that fuel so you didn't have all those forest fires. They had a healthy forest. Today's world, I think what they do is they jam too many trees per acre in there and create an unhealthy forest.
Well, Sam, it's really good to talk to you. Thanks so much for sharing this beautiful spot with me.
Well, you know, I'm always proud to share Chinook territory with anybody and being really close to the ancestors here. I mean, we're extremely close to the ancestors right here. They look down on us. And a lot of times when we're drumming and so forth, there's eagles that live in these trees. In fact, I picked up an eagle feather this morning walking down to the path, you know, and eagle feathers and deer and everything will come out to see what the Chinook people are doing. We strongly feel that, you know, our ancestors travel in that light fog on the water. And I've had several different times where I've had that, seen that ancestral presence. And one time we were, you know, when we're on canoe journeys, we travel from point A to point B, of course. And when we leave one tribe's area the night before, we usually have a skipper's meeting, skippers of all the canoes. And we get together with the tribal fishermen because the tribal fishermen know the waters like anybody, you know, nobody else. One thing they told us when we were traveling between Tacoma and Seattle is that when you go between the Tacoma Narrows, that make sure everybody's wearing their life jackets because that water just boils in underneath there. So I remember heading there, and first thing I realize is that you see the bridge for like 2, maybe 3 hours before you actually go under it. It's big, so it takes a long time to reach it. And I remember as we were approaching the narrows there, I'm thinking, okay, here we go. And I see this light fog on the water, just this real light fog. And when we got to the narrows, it was like glass. I mean, we went across that, it was just like skating across glass. So that was the first time I realized that, okay, the ancestors are here to take care of us. And then coming down the Columbia River, we'd stop at Skamakaway. Chief Skamak was a very powerful man that lived in Skamakaway, and there's a lot of ancestors up in those hills. And I remember the first time that we traveled down there, we came down, we nosed up, you know, on this big rock with some trees growing on it, you know, dense forest. And we started singing a blessing song. And as we were singing, the echo came back so spontaneous, it was like they were singing with us. And you wouldn't expect an echo coming out of a forest. You know, it's usually canyons or whatever, but it was coming back at us that quick. And then later on, we were going down, and we were upriver from the ancestors. We were all loading in a canoe, and it was a bright sunny day, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. There was no fog on the river or anything. And I looked down there, and I told everybody to look down. And there was a waterfall of fog coming off the hills where the ancestors are and going across the river waiting for us. So I'm like, wow, power that day. And then one day over here, when we were opening up the park here, there was some kind of a little bit of disagreement on where how well this was done. You know, so the elders were all sitting there, and they were all facing the hills where the ancestors were, and they were sitting there. And I got up with a few friends, and we started drumming the changer towards the end. The fog literally came down that hill and just stopped right behind us as we were singing. And all the elders said, life is good. Things like that happen.
Can you play one more song?
Sure. I'm going to do a song called The Changer. And The Changer is all about back in the day, the animals, before Chinook were here, the animals were here, and they were actually setting the rules that we were to live by. You know, how we dealt with birth and death and marriage and all that good stuff. And later on, you know, of course, The Changer meant several different things. And one of the things was Chief Seattle referred to The Changer as the Bostons, you know, that came into the area. And he just said, you know, The Changer's here, and life will not be the same for the Duwamish, and how true he was, you know, on that. But anyway, the song had left the Columbia River. It traveled, you know, because our ancestors traveled a long distance, and they would go up into southern Alaska, into the Sound, down to Northern California. This song had traveled away, and a gentleman named Sobie, a Skokomish, told the Shalapan, one of our shamans, that this song had roots on the Columbia River and it needed to come back. So he brought this song back to us. Oh, your way.
Today we've been talking with Chinook Tribal Council member Sam Robinson, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you're able, by becoming a member of KBOO during this fall pledge drive or renewing your membership. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online to kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Once again, thanks again for supporting KBOO. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.